I'll be delivering the last presentation of the symposium, and I'll be talking about can biochar and fermentation residual enhance biomass and soil carbon in elephant grass grown for bioenergy. And in doing so, I'll talk a little bit about a project that's encompassing a little more than that, but I'll focus primarily on that today. And you can see in the picture here, we have an example of bahia grass, Paspalum notatum, in the lower left there. And behind that and to the right there, we have elephant grass or Napier grass, Penicetum purpureum. And we started a study about 3 years ago now looking at how possibly converting land use to elephant grass would compare to bahia grass, which is a prominent pasture in our area. And before I get started, I'd like to acknowledge a lot of the collaborators on this project, in particular Maria Silvera, who's spearheading a lot of the soil carbon work on this project that I'll be presenting today, Ramon Leon, Lynn Sollenberger, and Lonnie Ingram, who's a microbiologist that's provided us with some of the fermentation residual, Joel Reyes, Jeff Fidenko, and Danilo Quadros are graduate students and visiting scientists that helped collect a lot of this data. And this work was supported by the USDA NEFA, and we'd like to thank them for that. Starting with a little bit of background here, about six, seven years ago, we were just getting started with a renewed interest in bioenergy here. Over the last 20 years, we had very little change in ethanol production, and since 2006 or 2007, that's increased dramatically to where we're at about 14 to 15 billion gallons of ethanol per year now, and that's stayed pretty steady now for the last 3-4 years, which is due in large part or associated with the renewable fuel standard, which also was put out around that time, 2007, which called for increased production of domestic biofuels. And you can see through the corn ethanol part, which was essentially capped around 15 billion gallons, they were pretty quickly able to achieve that. And the future and predicted growth in renewable fuels is now expected to come from cellulosic and other advanced biofuels, which you can see in the lighter blue color there. So we're at about 2015 now. We have our 15 billion gallons of ethanol from corn, and the expected increase from here is looking at lignocellulosic biomass. That's been pretty slow to get going. As mentioned a couple times, I think in the session, there are now a couple in the Midwest looking at using corn stover and starting to produce cellulosic biofuel from that. But there's been a lot of, it hasn't caught fire as quickly as possible. And a lot of that has been due to the economics. I think a lot of the work that's been done by the community here has shown that production of lignocellulosic ethanol and some of the other advanced biofuels is relatively expensive. And so a lot of interest has been generated in looking at co-products and other things that may facilitate or encourage biofuel production. And some of the things they're looking at in co-products are things like plastics. Whoops. if you'll notice your cups here, all made from corn, and they're looking at bottling and doing things like that to increase their potential competitiveness of cost competitiveness of using crops or bio-based products and biofuels, medical and pharmaceutical uses, and the one we'll be focusing on here today mostly is as soil amendments and looking at using those to help with ecosystem services in these bioenergy cropping systems. And so the project, I'll show you in a second, we're focused on a lot of these aspects, including water quantity, water quality, erosion control, climate regulation, and so specifically, the objective of this project I'll be talking about today is to compare the effects of converting conventional cropping systems, in this case, bahia grass pasture in our region, to elephant grass or bioenergy cropping systems on ecosystem services and particularly soil carbon today. And so if we come back to this picture again, you can see what we've got set up here is a randomized complete block design. This is just a view of one part of the block. And in the middle, you'll see a little white pipe there. Each of these plots has lysimeters installed below them that we're collecting the water that's moving below the rooting zones in these systems. And then we're comparing this bahia grass here to the elephant grass next to it. We're collecting data on soil carbon on an annual basis, and I'll talk a little bit about that, our sampling for that. So this site is located in north central Florida. If you're familiar with that, it's just south of Gainesville area. And this is a well-drained sand. It's a pretty low organic matter soil. I think some of the earlier speakers were talking about 2% or 2.5% organic matter in some of their soils. At this site, we're looking at about 0.5%, maybe 0.6%. So it's a pretty low soil organic matter soil. Our first treatment, as we said, is a conventional Pensacola Bahia grass is what we're using for that. We're managing that with 50 kilograms of nitrogen and potassium applied annually and harvesting that 3 times per year. And so we'll be summing the sum of those harvests for the biomass data. And then for our elephant grass treatments, we're using a breeding line from the University of Florida, which we're calling UF1. And we have 4 treatments with that. One is what we're calling a low input, relatively low for elephant grass, of 50 kilograms of nitrogen and potassium applied as synthetic fertilizer per year. And that same treatment then for treatment 3 is also done with the addition of a fermentation residual, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a second, as well as treatment 4 has the same fertility plus a biochar amendment. And the last treatment then is more of a high input treatment for elephant grass, 250 kilograms of nitrogen and potassium per hectare per year. So the fermentation residual that we're using, we're applying that once annually. This is a fermentation residual from lignocellulosic conversion. So this is something that's actually gone through a pilot plant facility that we have at the University of Florida, the UF Stan Mayfield Biorefinery. Which is it's a fermentation process that was converting the cellulose in a large part of the 5-carbon sugars. And so we get a fairly lignin-dense residue that comes out of this. We've been applying that at about 9 metric tons per hectare per year, usually in the spring, before or around the time of emergence. And the basis for that is roughly proportional to what you might get if you were to convert a hectare of elephant grass to lignocellulosic ethanol. The residue that you would get from a hectare, we're putting it back on that hectare in total. The characterization of this in terms of carbon and nitrogen, it's about 51% carbon and relatively high in nitrogen, which I think you'll see is part of the reason why we see some of the differences we'll see in a minute. The biochar, this is a commercial biochar that we're using. It's produced in Dunellen, Florida. It's actually off of mostly pine residues, but we weren't able to get them to convert our elephant grass to biochar for us, so that's what we had to use for this case. And this was about 62.5% carbon, but much lower in nitrogen at 0.2%. And again, that's applied about 5.5 metric tons per hectare, which is, again, roughly what we figured you might get if you were converting, you know, a hectare of elephant grass by pyrolysis and the biochar residue that would be associated with that. In terms of our sampling, we sample the above-ground biomass once annually. We just did it last week, actually. And so about this time of year, we'll collect the annual above-ground biomass for the elephant grass. The soil samples then are collected shortly thereafter in December and early January. We sampled to 80 centimeters and split that up into 5 depths. And from the cores that we collect off of that sampling, we collect data on root biomass, soil bulk density, soil carbon, and we have converted that then to soil stock, soil carbon stocks by depth in the soil. And so some of the data that we've gotten so far, here we have above ground biomass, and I should have put the years in, but these are the growing seasons. The first year would be 2013, 2014, the second year, and then the last year is just actually data we collected last week. I don't have that for soil carbon yet, but just for the above ground biomass. And so in the first growing season, we saw pretty good yields across the board with no real big significant treatment effects, no significant treatment effects. The first year there for the elephant grass, around 40 metric tons per hectare. And for the Bahia graphs, we're just getting that established. So you can see that has been showing a steadily increasing trend. With the second year there for the elephant grass, we dropped off in yield quite a bit and down to the upper 20s in terms of metric tons per hectare. And still hadn't seen any treatment effects in the second growing season. But it looks like this year we might finally be starting to see some of those differences. And I think if you've seen some of the talks yesterday, it's kind of consistent with the behavior of elephant grass the first couple growing seasons. It seems to do pretty well under any management scenario, even no input. And then by 3 and 4, 5 growing seasons, it starts to drop off pretty dramatically. And so if we look in the green there, that's our high input, our high fertilizer input treatment, starting to show maybe a little better yields in this third growing season. Interestingly, we didn't see a real big effect of that fermentation residual yet. That's the orange T3, treatment 3 there. And that is no different than the low input in the light green to the third growing season anyways. And interestingly, in this third growing season, it looks like we might actually be starting to see some potential negative effects of the biochar on above-ground biomass. I haven't even had a chance to actually analyze that data statistically yet, so we'll see whether that comes out. But it was pretty low variability and pretty consistently lower than the other treatments. In terms of looking at the root biomass, this is just data that we collect at the end of the second growing season. Like I said, we don't have that yet for the third growing season. And so if we look at these figures, I got several of them that will look similar to this, where we have our response variable on the x-axis and then soil depth on the y-axis. And so you're kind of going down into the soil as we go down the figure there. And so we have cumulative root biomass going across. And so for each depth, the prior depth is being added, so you can kind of see where the differences are occurring. And you can see not a lot of big differences in elephant grass treatments on the cumulative root biomass, with the possible exception of the vinasse, or the evaporated fermentation residual in orange there, is increasing some of the root biomass in the upper soil profile, and maybe not as much in the deeper soil profile. And the Bahia grass having similar amounts to elephant grass in the upper soil profile, but more root biomass deeper into the soil. One interesting difference we see here with the Bahia grass compared to the elephant grass, if you look, combine the first figure with the second figure, we have the root length density in the second figure, and the root length density is quite a bit lower for Bahia grass compared to elephant grass, relating to the root thickness, basically, of Bahia grass compared to elephant grass. So even though they have similar standing root biomass, it's quite a bit finer for the elephant grass, but not a lot of treatment difference in terms of specific root length or the diameters of the elephant grass treatments. So the soil carbon data, I'll present that for the 2 years that we have it by year, so we can see some of the initial effects after planting and then what we've been seeing as we go through year by year. And with this table here, I have the depth again on the first column there, and then the actual metric tons per hectare of soil carbon estimated at the outset of the study in the next column there. So that's 7 metric ton metric tons of carbon per hectare in the 0 to 10 centimeter profile in the first row, and so on and so forth as you go down. And then the total on the bottom is the cumulative from 0 to 80 centimeters. And then the treatments there, again, for treatment 1 would be Bahia grass, treatment 2, the low-input elephant grass, treatment 3, the low-input elephant grass plus the evaporated fermentation residual, and treatment 4, the biochar, and treatment 5, the high-input fertilization for the elephant grass. And so one of the things we saw pretty quickly in the first year, actually a loss of soil carbon, with the treatments that received pretty high inputs of nitrogen, being the fermentation residual, which showed a loss of soil carbon basically at all depths, and the treatment 5 showing pretty similar results with a loss of soil carbon at each depth, whereas the Bahia grass in particular showed a pretty substantial increase, and I'll explain probably a couple reasons for that. So it's, I think the Bahia grass is about 12 tons per hectare of an increase in the first year. And with the biochar treatment four, we saw about a 6-ton increase in the first year in total. And I think part of the reason, as you'll see, the bahia grass wasn't quite as big the next year is that we had to plant that from sprig sod type of thing, and so I think we imported some carbon with that compared to our initial conditions. So we have the same data here for the second year now, after the second growing season, and we start to see, again, some improvements in soil carbon more or less across the board. Even T3 and T5 showed an increase in soil carbon from year one to year two, but not dramatically so. They're both still about equal to what we started out initially. We see, again, another increase in soil carbon with the biochar treatment in T4 there. After 2 years now, about 43% increase and in total. And even the low input is starting to show some accumulation. And particularly one thing you'll notice here is all of the elephant grass treatments are showing some pretty big increases in soil carbon deeper in the soil profile. So we're starting to see that total increase with a lot of that showing up deeper in the soil profile. So if we take a look at that after year two, that same type of plot here, you can see the black dotted line there is sort of our initial condition, soil carbon conditions before the treatments. And then the light green is low input elephant grass. The dark green is high input. The orange is the fermentation residual. All of those are still pretty similar to initial conditions. But the bahia grass and the elephant grass amended with biochar started to show pretty significant increases in soil carbon. And again, a lot of that is showing up pretty deep in the soil profile. So some conclusions to wrap up those results. Elephant grass seems capable of sustaining pretty high yields in our region, around 30 tons per hectare. I think data from here and others are going to show that needs some level of input to sustain that. In terms of relating that to the bahia grass, we saw that bahia grass contained actually more biomass in terms of standing biomass, root biomass below ground than elephant grass across any of the treatments, and also had a lower specific root length associated with that. The elephant grass managed with the synthetic fertilizer inputs did not really appear to accumulate soil carbon, at least quickly in the first couple seasons, as bahia grass. However, if you are amending that elephant grass with biochar, we saw increases in soil carbon that were on par with bahia grass and maybe even better than bahia grass, depending on how much that was imported initially in that first year. However, we're starting potentially to see maybe some negative impacts of that biochar on yield. It'll be interesting to see what we see here in the next growing season. And finally, the addition of the fermentation residual we thought would have maybe some positive effects on yield because it is pretty rich in minerals. At least through the third growing season, we have not yet seen that response. Another possibility we thought maybe we'd see some benefit for soil carbon sequestration has not yet shown that, although if you go back and look, I think at this particular figure, I think in the upper soil profile we may be starting to see some of that starting to accumulate in that area of the soil. And so with that, I can take any questions that you may have as well. Yes, sir. Oh, I had those numbers. I don't remember them off the top of my head. You could do a quick off of those percentages, but I don't. Right, it was actually higher than the total high input one. I remember that. The fermentation residual, right. And the biochar would be a relatively low amount, I guess. Yeah. I don't recall exactly. That sounds about right.
I have actually one more. When it comes to ecosystem service, so bahia grass is better than
Depends what you want to look at. So far, it's definitely, you know, if you're comparing it particularly to the conventional practices, I would say yes, for sure, in terms of soil carbon sequestration. Again, you know, over time, how that will play out, we hope to do it at least one more growing season, and that's two more beyond what we have here shown for data. At least in terms of soil carbon sequestration, that's what we're seeing so far.
Yeah. John, there's a comment on the hay grass that's been found. That's interesting. You've got the accumulation down deep. They've done rotation cropping with the hay
grass
for peanuts, for example. And they've found incredible, you know, quite good increases in yield.
Right.
And a lot of that is considered because of the penetration of the roots and carbon
to the deep.
Down deep.
Right.
And allowing more of the nutrients, you know,
right.
more accessibility for the following crops. So I think the major graft would be another one. Would do that, but it's hard to
get rid of it and get your peanuts in the next year. And it's tough eradication. That may take a couple of years to do that. Yes?
I was just wondering how long can you maintain that current yield of alpine grass? And you saw that big decline in the second year as well, right?
Yeah. We haven't always seen that, and not to that degree. I think you did your first 2 years, you had almost no difference in yields. I think part of that might be water. So for our system, particularly the first year when we were establishing it, we tend to water a little more generously. And then that second year, you know, early in the season, we might when it's drier there. But other than that, we really don't irrigate these. And that year was a little bit drier maybe. So that may also contribute to why the third year performance might have been a little bit better on some of them too. But it's hard to say for sure. I know they've had it at some places for 20 years, right? So, but not in a production setting. Yes? That one was actually pretty close to neutral because I think they pH adjust it when they're done. Was that right, Maria? Do you remember for sure? I know the biochar was a little high in pH, 7 something. And I think the fermentation residual is 6-8 or close to neutral. I'd have to look to be sure. They do that as part of the process, I think. I'd have to check with Lonnie to be sure, but I can't remember. They add, I think, calcium carbonate or something to maintain the pH when they're fermenting. Yes.
If you still remember my one had some mortality issue after 3 years.
Yeah.
You've seen the like dead ones?
Not a lot yet, and it's hard to separate the way, you know, when we harvest it, they sometimes rip them out, and so you get some of that we transplant from borders or something the next year. But we haven't seen a lot of mortality yet, like in terms of stools mortality. We'll see this year. Yep.
I've got a question on the residual from the fermentation. As I remember, Lonnie, they used phosphoric
acid.
Did you measure the phosphate in that residual?
We did. And actually, Dr. O'Connor has done quite a bit with the phosphorus on that now. I don't remember what the levels were. And we've been measuring it in the soil every year and in the tissue that's being removed. So I have some of that data. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. But we have. Yeah, he uses the phosphoric acid pretreatment, which increases the phosphorus in that. So. Yes.
You had the other presentation earlier with switchgrass and other 24 different combinations. They didn't see an increase in soil carbon over 7 years, but you're seeing an increase within a short span of time. So is there a difference in the methodology? Like, are you including roots in your analysis as part of the soil carbon? Or?
No. I was hoping to present some data on the size classes. We're still working through some of that. But I think because it's such a low soil organic matter to start with, and that these crops are putting in a fair amount relative to what we're working with, we start to pick it up maybe a little quicker than they might in some of the other systems. I guess that'd be my best answer or best guess to that.
Right.
Particularly deep, you know, there's virtually no, in this particular soil, not a lot of carbon there.
Can you comment on the biochar interactions? You mentioned some negative direction that it's going. What's going on in the soil?
That's interesting. I didn't point that out, but. And I'm not sure you can see it real well, but you see on the figure to the right, it's actually increasing the rooting deep. So I'm somewhat wondering whether it's trying to avoid biochar to some extent and trying to root in regions away from that. I don't know. It's just we're doing repeated applications. You know, so it may one application or a certain amount may be beneficial, and it may get to a point where once you start adding enough of that, it may start to have some negative effects. Otherwise, we didn't see a lot of big effects on rooting, negative effects on rooting yet. Again, we do have some of the fertility data. We're starting to look through some of that, and there are some differences in terms of how different minerals, are extractable minerals in the soil, and how much minerals are being removed by the plants. I don't know if you have any comments on it. Possibly immobilizing some.
What's the pH of the soil?
The pH prior to it is probably 6-8, something like that. It'd be not too low. So. It actually came out. This is fairly, I think, the second year of cropping. It was a oak land before that. So it's a fairly new agricultural production area. Any other questions? All right, well, we have our business meeting then for those that are interested in sticking around for that. And then I think that'll be, we have one more poster session yet today, and that'll be the end of the bioenergy systems community. So thank everybody for coming.